It's a Man Crush Monday. Join Professor Buzzkill as he crushes on men from history who deserve more fame and glory.
Yes, Buzzkillers, it's a Man Crush Monday. A Man Crush Monday for you Patreon subscribers who are out there who are generous enough to support the show. Thank you so much for that. And thanks to Professor Philip Nash from Penn State, who's here in the Buzzkill Bunker to talk to us about this Man Crush Monday. How are you, Professor?
I'm doing all right. I'm crushing hard on this Monday.
This Man Crush Monday on Gustav Stresemann.
Stresemann
has got to be one of the most fascinating ones we've ever done, because of course we've read about it beforehand, but now we're going to enlighten the Buzzkillers.
Right, and as usual, I'm crushing hard on interwar German nationalists.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so I'm going to argue he's one of the most important non-Nazi politicians of the interwar period.
Okay, and so non-Nazi.
Non-Nazi. Yes, yeah. Not all Germans were Nazis, believe it or not. Not even close. So Gustav Stresemann. He was born in 1878 in Berlin. He was a businessman when he grew up. He was a pre-World War I politician in Germany, ultimately leader of the National Liberal Party.
Okay, now let's define that for the Buzzkillers.
Yeah, so, and this is small, well, it's a capital L in the name, but small L liberal, which is to say sort of free market liberal.
Yeah, right.
Sort of liberal economics, not liberal politics. Old school, plus nationalist. He's a career politician. His views sort of shift around on various issues. He was a monarchist, World War I German politicians, but also he was in favor of the welfare state.
Okay.
And let's keep in mind that Bismarck's Germany, the Wilhelmine Germany, actually had one of the strongest welfare states.
Yes, that's right. People forget that, yeah.
Right, which is interesting. Anyway, in the Weimar period, he helps found the Deutsche Volkspartei, the German People's Party, which is mostly a middle and upper class Protestant party. Fairly conservative, sort of lukewarm about the Weimar democracy. And as we said in another show, the Weimar democracy, that's one of its problems, is it doesn't have a lot of very deep support because it's a brand new democracy. A lot of people are suspicious of it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So how does Gustav leave his mark?
How does he leave his mark? Well, in 1923, which is the year of economic crisis and hyperinflation in Germany, and not coincidentally the year of Hitler's beer hall putsch.
Right.
He is briefly chancellor and foreign minister in the Grand Coalition. This happens in a lot of parliamentary democracies where the two main opponent parties sometimes join forces.
Because they have to.
Right, because they have to, right? That's happened in Germany recently. It's happened in other countries too. So he is the chancellor and foreign minister at the same time in a Grand Coalition. Thereafter, he is just foreign minister. That's his portfolio. He's the foreign minister, or as we would say, secretary of state. Under 8 different governments. He is now convinced that accepting the Weimar Republic, making a deal on reparations payments, which is what the money the Germans owe to the Allies under the terms of the Treaty of Versailles, 1919.
Right,
This is that accepting the Weimar Republic and making a deal on a reparations payments is key to ending Allied occupation of the Ruhr. R-U-H-R. This is the Ruhr area. This is Germany's industrial heartland, which was occupied by Allied soldiers in part to enforce reparation payments.
Oh, okay. We can't get our money back until we control that part of the German economy.
Right. Well, we don't want foreign troops occupying our industrial heartland. We want to get our sovereignty back, et cetera. And so he basically is a proponent of what the Germans call Erfüllungspolitik, which is to say basically compliance politics. Rather than resist the Allies, you at least minimally comply with Allied demands in order to get out from under their thumb.
Right.
So it doesn't mean you're a traitor, even though the Nazis would sort of tar you as a traitor if you took this stance. It doesn't mean you're a traitor. It means you're a pragmatist, right?
Okay.
You see what the situation is. Allies are dominant. They hold all the cards. Rather than resist and risk collapse, you go along to get yourself back on your own 2 feet as a country. So this would lead to economic recovery, which is what follows. Stresemann reconciles with the Western powers in the, if you study European history, famous Treaty of Locarno, 1925. Yep. This guarantees the western border of Germany.
Again, very important because that's, of course, the French border.
Right. Remember, 1919 at Versailles, the French get back Alsace and Lorraine, the two eastern provinces that the Germans had taken in 1871. And so, of course, if you're French, you're afraid the Germans are going to take these back again. So this basically is official declaration the Germans are not interested in altering the new western border as of 1919. Right. Germany had lost territory. In addition, they lost a little bit of territory to Belgium as well. This basically normalizes German relations with the West, paves the way for German membership in the League of Nations, right, which is our new international organization, also comes out of Versailles.
Yeah, and this is a very, very big deal.
It's a big deal, right? This is Germany is a pariah in 1919.
Mm-hmm.
By 1926, mm-hmm. it's no longer a pariah. Mm-hmm. It's slowly making its way back into the sort of the family of nations, if I can use that term. They have a seat on the council, which is sort of the Security Council,
right, of the League of Nations.
Right. It's the equivalent 1926, and for some good reasons, Schlesemann shares the 1926 Nobel Peace Prize with the French Foreign Minister Aristide Briand.
Right.
So he's. That alone makes him a major figure. He also reaches out to the United States. His diplomacy helps secure what's called the Young Plan.
Yeah.
This was a American-sponsored plan which reduced German reparations. Basically, it's like renegotiating. It's like a refi on your mortgage.
okay.
Basically.
Much
bigger scale, much, much bigger stakes, which reduces German reparation payments and helps make those payments a little more manageable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so Germany is no longer a pariah. And like I said, it's sort of crawling from the wreckage. And these 26, 27, 28, these are, everyone agrees, sort of the peak years of the Weimar period.
Okay. Right.
Germany's economy is recovering from the early 20s. The democracy is popular. The country's prosperous. German culture is flowering. These are the good years of the Weimar Republic.
Mm-hmm. So Stresemann is a hero.
Not so much.
Wait a minute. Professor, this is a man crush.
I know.
Monday.
Let me explain. Still crushing hard. But like I said, we're all about context
still
here.
Still
crushing hard.
Context and complexity.
Absolutely. Those are our buzzwords, if I can use that term. So there's always mitigation. No one's a complete hero.
Right.
He's still a fierce German nationalist. He wants Germany out from under the restrictions of Versailles.
Which
lots of people do, even people who brought the treaty to us, including in Britain. He wants Germany to become a great power again. Most ominously, he refuses a Locarno-type agreement in the East. And remember, Germany lost a lot. Its biggest territorial losses were in the East to create this thing called Poland. Including the Polish corridor, which gives Poland access to the Baltic Sea at the expense of dividing Germany, right? Breaking off East Prussia geographically from the rest of Germany, or sort of interwar geography lesson always looming there in the background. So, in other words, this would suggest that, you know, given his druthers, if he becomes Chancellor of Germany in the future and gets to run foreign policy as well, then maybe down the road he wants to engage in aggression against Poland to get that territory back. We don't know, right? He is a German nationalist. He laments the loss of that territory like other German nationalists.
But there's a reason we don't know what's going to happen.
Right, and that's because, I would argue, tragically, he dies suddenly in October 1929 of a stroke at the age of 51.
Right.
Which leaves us with an enormous what-if. What-ifs are always dangerous. We don't know. Who knows what would have happened?
Maybe
he would have ended up as a Nazi. I mean, we don't know because he died.
Right, right.
It's also possible he might have become chancellor again because he was a widely respected politician across the German political spectrum, certainly in the center, right? Mm-hmm. He has this Nobel Prize. Everyone knows he's a very effective advocate of Germany in international bodies and international context. Could he have done a better job than, say, Heinrich Brüning of guiding Germany through the Great Depression had he become chancellor? Might he have helped prevent the collapse of the Weimar Republic? We don't know. Probably not, right? He wasn't Superman.
But
I draw attention to him, and I'm crushing on him because he shows us, on the one hand, the potential of the Weimar Republic.
Which is
always remembered as this failed democracy that had all these flaws and basically gave up the ghost when the Nazis got strong. He's important because he represents an alternative vision of German nationalism.
Oh, okay.
Right? In other words, I am typically very suspicious of nationalism, don't consider myself a nationalist, but I am aware of the fact that it's possible to be a responsible nationalist. There are responsible nationalists all around the world, including in the United States. He represented a vision of German nationalism that was not this perverted Nazi type that we know very well for good reasons, right? Yeah. Maybe he was a German nationalist, an alternative to the Nazis that could have sapped some Nazis' support had he continued in politics and not died prematurely. I think he definitely deserves recognition as one of the greatest statesmen of 20th century Europe and fully deserving of my man crush.
Well, there you have it, Buzzkillers. Another wonderful Man Crush Monday that shows us not only the complications and makes us run interesting thought experiments about what if, but shows us why we have to keep reading into the details of all this history. So thanks to Professor Nash, and we'll talk to you next time.